Welcome, everybody, back to the Primary Breadwinner Women's Network. I'm your host, Pamela Johnston, and today I'm going to be interviewing psychotherapist Tricia Bennett. You are going to hear firsthand the pain that she has experienced as the primary breadwinner. You're going to hear about the painful moment of awakening and the transformation that she took herself through to really put her life on a path that gave her much greater satisfaction. Just a reminder to listeners to go to the website, www.thepbwnetwork.com. There you'll find more information about the network. I now would like to invite my guest, Tricia Bennett, to the network, and thank you so much for coming and being available to be interviewed, Tricia.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tricia, I do like to give a context to the generational aspects of the primary breadwinner woman. If you could tell us your age, that will give women a sense of where your story is.
Sure. I'm 51 years old, and I have been a psychotherapist for 30 years. I started my practice in Western Massachusetts, was out there for about 15 years, and I've been on Martha's Vineyard for about the same amount of time.
Can you tell me a little bit about the focus of your psychotherapy practice?
When I started, my focus was in the area of addictions, alcohol and drug, gambling, sex addictions, all different sorts of things that people can get addicted to. And I did that for about 10 years. And as the people that I worked with started to get healthier, my practice started to shift. And I started working with people who were healthier, who were interested in expanding in their own lives, whether it was in their career or in their spiritual life or in terms of their health, just moving toward bigger, better, happier lives. And so I've worked with individuals, couples, and I specialize in teenagers these days. I do a lot of work with young people between the ages of 12 and 18.
Can you tell me whether or not you were a primary breadwinner for any period of time in your adult life?
I consider that I've been a primary breadwinner, or was a primary breadwinner, from the time I was about 15 until I got married when I was 47, in that I pretty much paid for everything in my life from the time I was a teenager until I got married. Mm-hmm. I paid for my college education, my graduate work. I paid for my first home. And I also paid the majority of expenses in all of my romantic relationships from the time I was in college all the way until I married the person that I'm married to. So I would say for most of my life, I was the breadwinner in my life, the primary breadwinner.
Do you know of any reasons or factors behind that?
Well, I think that, you know, I grew up in a family that had a really strong work ethic. My parents also were both artists and musicians. And in the art world and the world of music, gender doesn't really come into play.
Mm-hmm.
You're either a good artist or you're not. You're either a good musician or you're not. There was no sort of gender identity around work in our house. So I didn't ever think that a woman did one kind of job and a man did another. And because my parents both made money, I just assumed that I would. Everyone in our family was educated, and everyone in our family at least got a master's degree, if not a PhD.
Now, in terms of the relationships that you had with men, what was your feeling about the man, and what did you think about your financial involvement in it?
I'm not sure how I ended up the way I did, because I know my father made more money than my mother did. There was something inside of me, maybe it was around worthiness, or maybe it was because my parents were both artists, that I was always attracted to artists, and the artists that I was attracted to never had any money.
Ah, yes. I know that one.
Because I had chosen to go into a field where I could make a good salary, I was making a lot more money than the men that I was dating. especially in my 20s and 30s, mm-hmm. when artists are developing their careers. I was already 10, 15 years into my career and in private practice, doing really well, tended to just be attracted to men who couldn't match me financially.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any respect issues with the man?
I honestly think I didn't know any better, if that makes any sense. You know, what I've realized now at the age that I'm at, I think that I didn't know how to be attracted to any other kind of man. It was almost like I had an internal blueprint for the kind of man that I was attracted to.
Right.
And it didn't occur to me until I was in my 40s that maybe I didn't need to date men who were struggling financially, that just because I was attracted to a certain kind of person, that it didn't mean that I had to be with someone who couldn't meet me where I was financially. It was really sort of like an epiphany to me, which I think for most people is sort of obvious, but to me it had never occurred to me that I could date a man who was doing equally well, if not better, than I was.
Interesting.
And so I sort of set out to teach myself how to be attracted to a different kind of man.
Yeah, and I know that's a big part of the work that you're doing today, and it's really, I think it's wonderful, the notion of making a decision to focus on an aspect of how we are in the world and set about changing it, particularly devoted and good at that.
You asked what impact did it have, and I think the impact that it had on me was that I was constantly feeling that, like there was something wrong with me because I was frustrated. And I felt like, gee, you know, I know this guy's doing the best that he can. Why am I so frustrated all the time? And the reason that I was frustrated is that because of my income, I was accustomed to making a certain amount of money. I was accustomed to being able to, you know, drive a certain kind of car and fill the tank whenever I needed to and go grocery shopping and buy the food that I wanted to eat and go out to dinner or go out with friends if I wanted to. I could take a vacation if I wanted to. I could go shopping and buy myself an outfit if I wanted to. And most of the men that I was dating were not capable of those things. They couldn't go vacation when they wanted to. They couldn't go out for a nice dinner when they wanted to. So my frustration was whenever I wanted to do something like that, the response that I got from the men that I was dating is, well, if you want to do that, you're going to have to be the one to pay for it.
Right, right.
And there was something for me as a woman that every time I heard that made me feel like there was something really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, why am I the one? I never heard that in my parents' house. I never heard my father say to my mother, well, if you want to go on a vacation, you're going to have to be the one to pay for it.
Right.
You know, I never once heard him say anything like that ever, but I just hadn't connected the dots. The men sort of would criticize me, too. They would say, well, you know, you make twice as much money as I do. I can't do those things that you want to do.
Yeah, it gets into some psychological mind play between the male and the female around the traditional roles.
I hadn't really seen very much of traditional roles in my family, although I'm sure I knew about traditional roles from TV and movies and all that kind of stuff. There was something innately in me that wanted to be taken care of, that
mm-hmm.
wanted someone to be able to take me out to dinner and pay the bill, because it was hard doing it all by myself, and I wanted someone to help me with it or to pick up the slack for me. I needed to do something and it was financially tough for me to swing it. I wanted somebody to say, oh, I'll take care of that for you.
Right.
Always being the one who had to do that was really frustrating.
What were your steps when you started to realize, or you had a as you say, a moment of awakening or an epiphany? Can you tell our audience what happened?
I had been dating a guy who was just horrifyingly cheap. You know, if we'd go out, he'd want to buy one meal. And it was almost like the universe was saying, are you done yet? Are you getting it yet? Like, yes. That this is just ridiculous. And the night he did that and wouldn't order another meal, he lived in Connecticut and I lived in Massachusetts. It was like a three-hour drive plus a boat ride to get back
to my house.
Things
we do.
Mm-hmm. And I got in my car and drove. I got at the restaurant, I got right in my car and drove and left him without a vehicle at the restaurant in Connecticut.
Yay! Well, it's great when we figure it out, eh?
Yeah, and I was done.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself all the way back on my three-hour drive, I will never date another man who can't provide for me, who doesn't want to provide for me. I have provided for myself and every other person in my life since I was 15 years old, and I am done.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. And I
Great.
Was done. I was absolutely done. And that's when I started to look for women in my life who were happily married to men who were primary breadwinners.
Mm-hmm.
And to men who were generous, loving, kind primary breadwinners, who had grown up in families with fathers who were generous, kind primary breadwinners, and had wanted to do it since they were children. When those men were boys, they were looking forward to growing up and being husbands and dads.
Right.
And taking care of their families. And I started asking those women, how the heck did you choose your husband? How did you know how to choose someone who would love you and take care of you and be generous and kind? And
mm-hmm.
that was the beginning of my process of learning how to allow a man to come into my life and not feel like I had to be the one to financially take care of everything.
Right. So the journey started, and I would imagine that there had to be a learning curve for you just to be in a different sort of comfort zone with men that were in such a different frame of mind vis-a-vis the earning the money and taking care of a woman.
I was probably in my late 30s when I had that epiphany, and I met my husband in my late 40s. So it took me about 10 years of trial and error in dating and being supported by these amazing, amazingly generous women who stuck with me for the entire time and kept sort of honing my skills and my willingness, kept asking me questions and asking me what I really wanted in life and what I really wanted from a partner,
mm-hmm.
what I really wanted a marriage to feel like, what I wanted it to feel like to be in a relationship with a man. And they really helped me to get really, really clear about how I wanted it to feel. And they also told me that I didn't have to settle,
mm-hmm.
that it didn't matter how old I was. All I had to do was be really clear about what I wanted. And as soon as my vision was crystal clear, that he would appear.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened.
But along the way, I'm interested in
yeah.
in the journey of along the way that you're dating and you're meeting various men, and it certainly must have been a process of becoming
yeah.
more yourself and more,
yeah.
And therefore maybe or more authentic in those exchanges with those men. And
yeah, it was really believing that if I could do it, there certainly was a man out there who could pull it off, who
right.
could be the primary breadwinner and want to be generous and loving and kind and all those good things. What I would do is I would date somebody. I'd go on a date, and I'd find out about them, and I'd go back, and I'd talk to my married friends, and I would say, well, he was okay, but there were a few things that concerned me, and I would discuss the things that I was concerned about, whether it was the person's age or that I might have to move or that I wasn't sure that they were financially stable or that I wasn't sure there was the right chemistry. I would discuss whatever my concerns were. And my married friends would either say, I think he deserves another date, or they would say, trust yourself and move on.
Great, eh?
Yeah. I mean, it was really incredible because I absolutely trusted these women
Right.
Because of the lives that they had. I knew they were happy, and I knew that they had what they wanted in terms of their marriages and families. And
yes.
I absolutely trusted them. Each time I would end a date or end, you know, maybe I'd go on three or four dates before I was sure that the person wasn't right for me. And I would say, you know, I think you're a really great guy, but we're not quite a perfect fit. Every time I would do that, the caliber of the next man would be a little better.
Yeah.
Because I was raising my own bar.
Right.
And
yeah.
I met my husband on Match.com, which is, there's a nice advertisement for Match.com on your podcast.
Yeah.
But I met my husband on Match.com, and neither one of us thought that we would ever meet anyone on a computer. But what I did also while I was online dating is I continued to refine my profile. I continued to make it more and more and more authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also specifications. When you go online, you can specify the kind of man that you're looking for, and income can be one of those specifications. You can say, I only want to date somebody who makes over $100,000 or over $200,000. I raised the bar. I said, okay, I'm not going to look at men who make less than $100,000.
Right. So you had some built-in protection. Well, obviously it worked, because I know that you have been very happily married. Now, how long have you been married?
Together for 8 years, married for 5.
Wonderful.
And as my husband would say, it feels like forever.
In a good way.
In a good way.
Yeah. And I know that really your life is quite transformed over the years, and both personally and professionally. Can you tell us a little bit to what life is like now, both on the personal and the professional front?
I always say my businesses are never planned. They fall into my lap, and they become businesses. I am an author of curriculum for children living with alcoholism and drug addiction in their families, and my curriculum is used around the world. And I do that in part of my spare ha-ha time. I have another small company called Grace Happens, which is bumper stickers, T-shirts, mugs, and different fun things that just say Grace Happens on them. There's no other message or motive. That little company is the smallest company in the world to be licensed by the estate of Albert Einstein, which is really fun.
Oh, neat.
And then the third thing that I do in my spare ha-ha time is I run workshops for single women who want to be married and aren't sure why they're not, that they've been successful in every other area of their life except for finding the love of their life. I use all of the great, amazing information that I got from the almost 24 married women that supported me over the 15-year period that I was looking for my husband. I have started doing those workshops around the country.
Right, and that is something that we are going to look further into in a future podcast, and I certainly am hopeful that I will be able to get you and your associate Heidi up to Toronto and have a live event here.
Ooh, fun.
Yeah.
I love doing those live events.
Yeah.
I love getting those girls married to the perfect man.
Well, you know.
So much fun.
Uh-huh. Yeah, what great work. And I'm sure that a lot of our listeners will be interested in finding out more about that.
Yeah.
And I do thank you so much for joining me today.
Sure.
And giving us a little peek into the window of your world and all the things that have gone on in the past. And I look forward to finding out more about the exciting things that are going on right now and bringing you into the network and making your services available to the women and men that I hope will be joining us.
Great.
My guest has been Tricia Bennett. The website for the network is www.pbwnetwork.com. There you will be able to find more information about our network. So that's it for today's podcast. Thank you for joining me.